Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for another awesome and amazing Behavior Health Integration episode. Today, we have two very special guests. The first one is a returning special guest, Rebecca Erickson. And the next one is the first-time special guest, Brittany Lindsay. Both of these ladies are master-level clinicians. Rebecca is a LAMFT. She is a self-starter, highly motivated, and keenly driven self-employed CEO and owner of the Hayreen Counseling, as well as a life and relationship coach. Brittany is a passionate behavior health professional delivering valuable insight to thought leaders in healthcare on a lifetime mission to create opportunities to improve behavioral healthcare accessibility and efficiency in every way possible. Brittany is currently running her own consulting company called Brittany Lindsay Consulting out of Boston, Massachusetts. In this episode, we will go through many different factors on how the mental health system can be improved as it comes to therapist burnout, high-level caseloads, lack of pay, deeper issues as it comes to lack of funding, and much more. So without further ado, let's get started. Well, again, thank you, Brittany and Rebecca, for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, no problem. Absolutely. I'd love to be here.
So, Brittany, it is your first time being on the show. Again, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Would you like to tell the audience a little bit about yourself, just to start off?
Sure. Yeah, I would love to. My name is Brittany Lindsay. I'm a licensed mental health counselor in the state of Massachusetts. I'm originally from Maine, a little town outside of Portland, Maine, actually. That's where I grew up. And then I attended UMass Boston for undergraduate school and then moved back home and went to University of Southern Maine, got my master's degree in clinical mental health counseling, started practicing clinical counseling in 2012, kind of bounced around, did, you know, community clinic stuff, worked in some K-12 schools, made it sort of to the pivotal place of private practice. And then ultimately, due to a couple different reasons, you know, burnout, moral injury, low pay, all of the things that we're familiar with as therapists, made the transition to pivot towards something else. And I pivoted towards health insurance and took that on as kind of a role that I wanted to understand better. And kind of for the past 6 years, have been working in health insurance and learning a tremendous amount of all the gears and levers and the bigger picture in healthcare. So that's where I'm at. So I have a background kind of on both sides of the coin. And So again, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. And Rebecca, would you like to tell the audience a little bit about yourself? I know you are a returning guest, but.
Sure. Yeah, no problem. So I'm not native Minnesota. I was born in South Korea, but grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota for pretty much my whole life. And then I first got my undergraduate degree in music performance from the University of Minnesota, played professionally in a music band for about 6 or 7 years, and then got burnt out from that. Went to grad school at St. Mary's University in Minneapolis and got my master's in marriage and family therapy. And then I've been on track to getting my full license for marriage and family therapy since then, which is 2015. I graduated. So since 2015, I've been on track. It's been a long road. I've had many different roles in the mental health field, as well as you, Brittany. I've never been out to the insurance side, but I did do some case management for a while, and I was a manager of a group home for a while, and worked in ERTS facilities, AFCs. Then I did some private practice work recently. I started my own private practice, and then after that, that's kind of when I started delving more into private practices. And that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Well, congratulations on the private practice. Oh, thank you. That can be a hard thing.
It is very challenging, but it's also really exciting. I love the challenge. Yeah.
Awesome.
Thank you.
So to start off, as we all know, this episode will be more based on like things that really need to improve in the mental health addiction system, not just again for the clients and them receiving good quality therapy, but just for the clinician themselves. And there's a list of issues that is not just going on in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Boston, but around the country. And I really want this episode to be about how we can like work on improving the system, because we know there's issues. So what do we have to do as therapists to fix them, right?
Definitely. Sorry, Brittany, if you want to speak on that. I just was going to say that, like, after having worked in several community-based fields in mental health, I realize one of the main issues or problems is just organization. It seems like ERTS facilities, AFCs, residential, you know, and or like community-based like ARMS, like they're great organizations out there, but they're so like they lack leadership and organization within the company that makes administrative problems get in the way of client care. And I just wanted to point out there real quick that I think a huge problem is administrative issues.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll go in a slightly different direction just to start. That's obviously a huge broad question that you asked, Jacob, and there's so many ways we could take that. But one of the things that I, reflecting back now, think that should be different is starts in graduate school. And the way we parse out social work programs and LMFT programs like yours, Rebecca, and the clinical counseling program I was in, there's a lot of like comparison, which one's better, which one helps people more, which one has better job satisfaction, this, that, and the other. And I still see that even in seasoned clinicians, the comparison or advocating for only social workers or advocating for only clinical counselors. And some of that, you know, is necessary. We all have our own boards and our own professional organizations, but I think we could make a lot more progress coming together, right? This collective group of mental health professionals that none of us are better than the other or really have more expertise than the other or have more meaning or should take up more space, right, in the field. If we can really work together and see ourselves all as equally valuable and an equal sort of piece of the puzzle in the larger landscape, you know, of our profession, that would go a long way, I think, in kind of having a unified voice for making the changes that need to happen.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you on that. I feel like there seems to be this kind of comparison specifically between LPCCs and LMFTs. And it just doesn't have to be, because we work with generally the same clients, and an LPCC therapist can work with children just fine, as much as an LMFT can work with children and families, you know. I don't like how there's just this like categorization and kind of like, well, you know, this is not your camp, don't come in here. And I think that if we all can see each other as pretty much, you know, different licensures, but different perspectives, but all coming from the same place and join together, like what you just said, I think that is definitely a first step that needs to be taken if we're going to, you know, work with the system and change the system ultimately.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. We see that still a lot. And just for the record, LMFTs and professional counselors have a lot in common in terms of the barriers to where we can get jobs, the fact that Medicare doesn't want to reimburse us. I mean, LMFTs and LPCCs. There's like three different acronyms depending on what state you're in for professional counseling, but counselors and LMFTs should really be more of a partnership, right? Than a divide.
Exactly.
For sure.
Exactly. Yeah. I was also going to say that I really like what you said, Brittany, about how it starts in grad school, because when I was in grad school back in 2012, when I started, there wasn't really much discussion about what's going to happen to you when you graduate, when you're looking for your license, you know, pursuing your license. And then when you do get your license and all that, I mean, yes, they talked about the process of, oh, you want to get these hours and stuff, but they didn't talk about all the social aspects of it or the burnout, you know, potentiality and the difficulty with getting paid licensure, paid supervision in a workplace. And I really feel like, I mean, I really love St. Mary's University and I fully support them, but I wish that they would have said more about the difficulty of getting paid supervision, because that is what has kept me behind from getting licensed. Mm-hmm. That is like the only thing, is the financial barrier, because it's like $2,000 of towards supervision that I have to pay out of pocket if I don't find it in my workplace, which I have not been able to find that in the whole time that I've been graduated to now.
Yeah, $2,000. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you. It's a huge problem and it happens in a lot of states. I was fortunate, you know, working in Maine when I was provisionally licensed, that you always had supervision as part of your employment, even when you were a new clinician or provisionally licensed. So I didn't face that barrier. However, working on the health insurance side, I have known a lot of clinicians from a lot of different states, and particularly southern states. You know, like in South Carolina, I know a lot of clinicians who, you know, did their graduate program, but even in their places of employment where they were starting to get traction with clinical, they never had an opportunity for supervision. And it was something they had to seek out on their own time with their own money. And it causes such a barrier, you know, to getting to that next level of having your full license. And so I think in these states where they don't offer things like paid supervision or having that built in to your workplace, that is a huge, huge barrier to having the type of clinical workforce that's needed in so many states. Mm-hmm. And it seems like something that could be really easily fixed, you know, if we could embed that into the community programs or where new clinicians are going. It seems kind of like a no-brainer, right?
Mm-hmm. I do know that a lot of places where I have like had in the past applied to and like or interviewed with, you know, they do provide supervision on site with a LPCC or LICSW, but it just seems to be the case with LMFT that is just so challenging to find paid supervision. So And I think that is one thing that like I can personally advocate for, you know, with my LMFT board, and say, like, if you want us to be in the workforce, you really need to provide, make more supervisors available and just things like that. So, but I want to just say that, you know, they do provide paid supervision, but unfortunately LMFT seems to be grossly underrepresented in the state of Minnesota for some reason. I don't know why. Which is very unfortunate for people like me who are still struggling to this day, you know, from graduation of 2015 to try to get their license because of supervision.
That's so disheartening, you know, here you've been through so much, you know, so much schooling, so much practice, you know, you have so much clinical skill and prowess, I'm sure. And to not be able to, you know, to get over that finish line, because that means so much, right? To be independently fully licensed, that means so much for you and your clinical practice and career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can only imagine how many people are in that exact position or like struggling, like I was mentioning, to scrape together the money to pay for their own supervision and get those hours documented. You know, we really don't have to look very far, right? To see why the workforce shortages are so profound.
Right. Mm-hmm. Agreed.
You know, and you really start thinking about like deeper meanings about how we're not necessarily taken care of. And I just feel like, and again, I don't want to get too political, but I feel like the politicians are saying like two different things, how they value mental health, but again, they're not willing to really put a lot of money or time or effort into it. And it really makes me worried about like the future clinicians. If we're having so much problems now, what's going to happen in 10, 15 years, you know?
Right.
Yeah, it's a scary thing to think about, right? Because there is a huge, huge percentage. I don't know if it's half, but like if you think about all of the outpatient mental health providers in the entire country, what percentage of those are in private practice or would prefer, you know, ideally to be in private practice? It might be upwards of half, right? Because I know that there's half of all clinicians roughly who don't accept insurance. They just don't work with insurance. So, you know, that's kind of a unique, I think, outlier in the mental health profession. That's probably not as profound on the medical side, right? A lot of medical professionals are part of a hospital system, or they're maybe in smaller practices that are attached to a hospital system. The mental health world is not quite like that. It's a different landscape in terms of how many people are in private practice. And what we see, to your point about politicians and legislation, is that there is no legislation being passed that's supportive of mental health practitioners in private practice, right? We're seeing a lot of legislation being passed that supports big hospital systems and how those folks are reimbursed. Like, I don't know if you guys saw, but like Medicare is able to continue their telehealth billing and services, but only in regards to the hospital systems. Only hospital systems are allowed to continue billing Medicare telehealth once the pandemic status is over or whatever. So it's things like that that really are kind of stacking the odds, I think, against folks who want to be thriving in private practice and hanging their shingle out like you, Rebecca, you know, doing their own thing. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to be in private practice and see a clientele that we want to, or be able to, you know, see folks who are on Medicaid, those lower income populations, have kind of a mixed variety. Those are the types of things that offset balance, right? To our professional world. And I just, the further we go here, the less I see that being supportive. So it's concerning. It's concerning about how that's going to go in the future state, at least from my perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately, the practice that I'm a part of is a group practice. So I have a clinical director, and then it's very small. It's just me, one of the therapists, and a clinical director. And the clinical director, you know, is fully licensed. And so both me and the other therapists are pre-licensed. So we go through our clinical director for licensure. So obviously we don't make as much money as if we were independently licensed. And then when we do get to that point, we will make more, obviously. But for the time being, that's kind of like how we are able to, you know, get the experience of being in a practice and, you know, get the experience of working with insurance, things like that. But I think that a lot of people who are off on their own completely, my aunt, she's also a therapist. She's off on her own completely. And she's also gotten to the route of taking private pay only, because just insurance is just not working for her. And so I feel like maybe potentially the future of new clinicians coming in who are like newly licensed or they're pre-licensed can join a very small practice instead of being completely on their own. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, like I just said, like clinical director, one or two other therapists, because it seems to be enough to provide support for each other. But then also we can still bill insurance through our clinical director.
Mm-hmm. That was where I was happiest too. When I was in private practice, I worked with two wonderful psychologists, and it was just the three of us, and we did awesome work, and we had a great pace. And we had a very sort of specific niche where we dealt with a lot of neurodivergent kids and their families. And it was awesome. But oftentimes when you're in a small group practice like that, is a really low margin for profit, right? There's not a lot of room for error. They got to take a decent chunk from your hourly wage to pay the overhead costs. And so that can still, you know, be a grind. What I think maybe future new therapists will be likely to do is work for like these franchisees that are coming nationwide, like Works. And I think there's a couple others where they kind of take that overhead cost and burden of working with insurances and step away from you. I'm sure there's cons to that. I haven't done it myself, so I can't speak to it too much, but I think that's maybe a route that will have a lower barrier to entry than kind of everyone's reinventing the wheel all over again in small private practices, but it is so lovely to be a part of one.
Yeah, and actually I did have the rather short opportunity to work for a franchisee private practice.
Okay. So
I was not an independent contractor. I was actually W-2, but my role was very similar to an independent contractor, and it was with a large corporation, but within my department was 10 therapists. And you know, I worked with the licensure of my supervisor. So pretty much kind of like what I'm doing now. But the thing is that because it was part of the umbrella was a large corporation, there was still disorganizational administrative HR issues. And it was just really getting to the point of, I was just so, I don't want to say done with that, but just, you know, had dealt with organizational issues for so long with so many different companies. I'm like, I'm going off on my own. And like the group practice was as close as I could get to still having that nice, you know, secure, like being able to correspond between other therapists, but then also being on my own. But I agree with you that I think that the franchisee kind of model of, you know, hiring like multiple therapists under like the umbrella of a large corporation. I think that's probably the way of the future I see as well.
And thanks for sharing your experience with that. And I think the underlying issue that we're not talking about, right, is that everyone leaves community mental health.
Yes.
Yep. No one stays, which is a whole, probably a whole other hour discussion itself.
But. Well, let's be honest. Is it due to like the 25 client caseloads, lack of pay, stress? I mean, there's reasons.
All of it, Jacob, all of it.
Yeah. And also just like the unresponsive, like, people from above, you know, the administrative people, like you have a problem with organizational thing or a client or some kind of policy, and you try to bring it to the HR or like your supervisor, and nothing changes. And your questions are valid. They're related to client care, and nothing changes. So it's like, what's the point?
And it's also totally not all bad. That's how I kind of cut my teeth. I did my internship in a community mental health center, and I actually worked in a like a different non-clinical capacity before that for several years. So I was like well versed in all the community mental health center stuff in the Portland, Maine area. And I was able to see such a diverse clientele. I was working with like refugees and immigrants from Africa, and I was doing substance use work, and I was doing like all this cool stuff with different populations, and got great supervision, had awesome colleagues. Like the people who are doing the work are wonderful almost everywhere you go, right? That's not the problem, but it's all the other stuff. It's like probably having to live at home forever if I keep working here, right? Because I can't afford to be an independent adult with the salary I'm making, right? I have these billable requirements. One of my first therapy jobs in a different clinic was 26 billable hours a week. And if I didn't hit that, I got spoken to, or it could even get taken out of my pay. And just things like that are so demoralizing, particularly for new clinicians who are just trying to figure out how they're becoming the best version of, you know, their own self in the counseling world. So it's a hard place to be.
Absolutely. I agree. And it's sort of like, at least here in Minnesota, from my experience, it seems like you kind of just have to go through that phase in your career before you can like move to a different phase where you're more like independent. It just seems like I've talked to other clinicians who are starting out, and for them to get a independent licensure, independent contractor position fresh out of grad school seems pretty unusual. Mm-hmm. So it just seems like it's kind of like an unspoken, like, okay, well, got to go be an arms worker for like 3-4 years. And then I can like, you know, move out of that. And not to say that arms work is terrible. It's not. I actually really enjoyed a lot of my arms clients and working with arms work as arms worker. And learned a lot, like what you had just said. But I just wanted to say that it just seems like in here, at least here where I'm from, that it seems like the you know, kind of like the entry level grunt work that you have to get through, and then you can go on to something else.
Yeah. And you know, I think it's not even that people want to leave. It's they're forced to, right? Yeah. For some of the reasons that we mentioned. And like there's no mechanism within like community mental health for longevity. Like, right, how are we supporting that new, like vulnerable workforce or even seasoned clinicians, right? There's some really special people who stay in community mental health for the long term who are incredible people. But they're far and few between. Like how exactly are we building an infrastructure here where people can stay and make a living and feel good about being engaged in community mental health? Because oftentimes those are the folks, right, who access community services who are in the most need of a lot of expertise of seasoned clinicians who can make a meaningful impact. Of course, not that new graduates and new clinicians cannot, but it would be very helpful, right, if we had a better blend, a better mix of seasoned and new and people who really felt like if they wanted to work in community mental health for the rest of their life, that would be a great decision for them. And we just don't have that.
Agreed. And I just also want to say that, like, I think a potential solution would be if it was possible to just increase the hiring for community mental health services, because from my experience, there's always such a lack of staff, and that made things so much more challenging. But if there was a way that we could like somehow increase the amount of people in that particular part of the field, that would definitely make things a lot easier. Hopefully the caseload would be less, if the caseload was less, if it was like instead of 28 billable hours, if it was like 10 or 15 billable hours, but yet you also got able to be paid the same amount that you normally would with 28 billable hours, like I think that would attract more clinicians and make the load, the caseload and just the workload way more realistic.
Right, right. At the end of the day, it comes down to funding largely, right? If we're able to fund more positions, if we're able to pay therapists, whether they're new or seasoned, what they're worth, then that creates a mechanism where people can have caseloads that don't completely demoralize them, right? Or completely dysregulate their nervous system day in and day out. And we can start to build, you know, some traction for people to stay in it for the long haul and create, you know, some hope for future clinicians that actually I will be able to make a living and feel good about this work. And, you know, again, they're just, we just haven't seen that kind of, there's a lot of talk, right? Mental health is so sexy. It is everywhere, but we do not have a lot of budget and dollar being really committed to the clinicians who need to be doing the work, right? The people we need to pay to make this really viable.
And would you say that that begins at the legislative level?
Yeah. Yeah, where else, right? I mean, there could be states, like I live in the Northeast, so there are wealthier states near me, and they have, comparatively to southern states or poorer states, much more robust budget, right, for mental health services, a lot more programs, tons of hospital systems near me, but that is not translating to clinicians making much better money, you know, when you control for geographic reason, region and cost of living. Like, I really don't see any clinicians killing it, making, you know, even, I don't know, I don't want to say like rich, obviously that's not the right word, but even just like getting by, feeling good about their income, like they're being paid commensurate to their work and value of services. We really don't see that anywhere. So, you know, there's certain small groups that hold all the money in healthcare. I don't have to say who they are. We all know who they are, right? The big conglomerates. And they don't want to give it up. So I think without congressional action, without legislation that really mandates that, I don't see that picture changing much. So yeah, I agree. I think it really does sit at the congressional, you know, highest federal levels to call to action.
Well, Brittany, I know one of your recent posts, I think you said something about like, the other day, someone kept texting me about a substance use counselor, right? A position. I'm going to tell you right now, you are almost literally 100 spot on when it comes to this, of an average pay of $62,000. And so again, after taxes, that's 800 a week.
About, yeah, I live in Massachusetts. So I factored in, you know, 30% or so for taxes and like whatever, you know, benefits may have been taken out of that. But yeah, so that was, that's what's being offered. And, you know, again, I'm in the sort of greater Boston area, fourth most expensive city in the United States. 62K probably sounds really good to people in different areas of the country. You know, I know like entry level counselors in South Carolina are making like $29,000,
$30,000 a year. Oh my gosh, you have to be kidding me.
So it's certainly not the worst where I am, but based, you know, considering cost of living, like I said, like we would literally have to sell our house if I wanted to take a position like that. So, you know, and again, you know, that's not the fault of community mental health clinics either, because again, they don't have the funding. They're paying as much as they can really afford to pay, and they're still taking a loss on most of the services that they are offering to the community. So it's bigger than that. It's bigger than at the local level, and in a lot of ways bigger than even at the state level. So yeah, that's just the microcosm, I think, of what a lot of even fully licensed professionals are dealing with.
And so then my question is, how do we advocate for and sort of, I wouldn't say train, but just cultivate more clinicians who are not, well, I guess sort of like more equipped to tackle the legislative piece, you know, like willing to go out there to be representatives of different, like different organizations in mental health. And so that we can get our representations in, we can get our legislation to advocate, provide for us, you know, like make change laws and policies to provide for us financially, but also for services that we may need as mental health clinicians. Like what's it going to take to do that?
Yeah. So, you know, I don't have all the answers, of course, and it's going to take a whole movement of people who are kind of elevated to this level of consciousness and advocacy and really committed to showing up in a different way for mental health professionals. But I think number one, that it starts in graduate school, and we need to do a better job helping new graduates and new clinicians understand their worth and their value in the world. We're very much sort of entrenched in this idea that we're, you know, not in it for the money. And, you know, it's almost like we're committing ourselves to poverty, which is, of course, how social work started. But in the modern day, that can't be how it works. We're just not going to survive. So we need to help people understand that they do have value in any market. And what does that look like? Put some numbers on it. Help people, you know, advocate, negotiate for their pay. Like, those are skills that most empaths and people who tend to be helping in the helping professions don't always have to advocate for themselves. So I think we need to do a better job there out the gate with new folks. And then the other thing I would say is that we need to be paying attention to the bills that are being introduced. You know, what is the House of Representatives doing? What is the Senate doing or not doing, you know, to get in the way? And, you know, do you know who your local state reps are? Do you know who you can email? Like, do you know who represents you? And, you know, I've done that in the past. Like, hey, this bill is important to me, like the mental health parity laws and the payment under Medicare for counselors and LMFTs. You know, I have messaged and tried to engage very strongly with my local representatives and said that, you know, I am one of these people and this is very important to me. And what are you doing? You know, and trying to at least have a dialogue, maybe not that confrontational, but, you know, I need help here. And how are you representing me as a constituent? And how can we do better? How can we advocate? And so, you know, I think getting sort of involved in the political process is, again, not something that clinicians really are maybe fired up to do, but I don't see another way.
Definitely. And I think that starting might be the hardest thing, just because there might be clinicians, especially ones getting straight out of grad school, who want to just focus on the therapy. They want to focus on, you know, being with the clients, you know, focusing on that. And the last thing they may be interested in is going to the state. And I think that getting the motivation and that seeing how necessary, how vital this is for the future of their, not just financial well-being, but just like the well-being of the entire community and, you know, the entire profession is so important. It's like this has got to happen. So I think that maybe even somehow if there was a way to introduce a secondary degree program at a university, like mental health, like you're a mental health clinician, but you're active in the, you know, political skyscrape of, you know, everything. And just like, but your focus would be like mental health in, you know,
I love what you're saying, Rebecca. Like, there should be tracks for, like, you know, healthcare reform or healthcare policy. You know, we should probably be taking courses on that stuff. And because we know that there's so much work room to improve healthcare in this country, that should be part of it. And I will say that I was one of those people. I became a professional counselor. I wanted to do one-on-one counseling, and that is all I cared about. Yep. For a long time, right? Focusing on becoming the best clinician, one person at a time in the therapy room. And that is totally normal and totally valid. And I think it's sort of right with time. We sort of pick our heads up. We see the bigger picture over time and we sort of understand how important those larger aspects and that 30,000 foot view really is. So definitely it's not to shame anybody if it's not their call to action or not what their attention is focused on, but it's definitely a part of it, right? It's definitely a part of what we need to be paying attention to make it better for everyone.
And I was going to say that my other part-time job is I work at like a natural foods co-op, and I work with a lot of people that are in their early 20s. And I think that it's just so incredible that a lot of these folks are so politically driven and just politically aware and focused on like incorporating politics in every different aspect of career and life. So I can kind of see there being somewhat of an interest or market or some kind of pull towards, you know, mental health and politics, and having that be an actual degree that you get, or maybe even a license type that you get, you know, in the future. I could see that happening.
Yeah, I'm like smiling as you're talking because younger people make me so hopeful. You know, it's like with each generation, right? We kind of get more aware. We elevate our consciousness with each generation, and they want their healthcare and they want their mental health services. And I think they're going to do some really great work. I mean, I'm an old millennial. I'm 35. I'm like an older millennial, but you know, millennials and Gen Z and you know, the next, like I feel really hopeful for what they see and what they're grounded in this area. So I agree with you, Rebecca. I think it's definitely really nice to see.
That's why I'm always personally a strong believer in helping the next generation out. Where Rebecca, I'm sure we talked about this in past episodes, but it's like, I want to make things easier for them where I feel like it's important for them to get to the goals where they need to. Like I kind of complain about the length of supervision we need to do. And I feel like we need to shorten that. And again, make the path just a little bit easier for them. And again, not have that ego where, oh, well, I did it this way, so you need to do it this way. It's like, no, again, that's not helping the future generation. We got to make it better for them.
Definitely. And I think that like, so when I was doing, well, actually I still am, but when I was doing group supervision, the things that we focused on in our discussions as a group, we didn't talk about legislation or politics or anything involving insurance, you know, anything like that. And I think even start with people who are currently like in the process of getting their license, we don't necessarily have to only focus on graduates or people that are soon to be graduating. You know, we can start with every person, whatever stage they're at in their career, because young people are extremely powerful and they're like that burning energy force behind what makes a change. But I think that they also are going to need a lot of support from more seasoned clinicians and or even people that are like where they're going to be in like 5 to 10 years from now, you know? So I think that like, you know, for people listening to all of this, that, you know, it's not just because you're not like in grad school doesn't mean that you can't, you know, be an active participant in all of this change.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's the more seasoned clinicians, right? And the folks who have been around for a while that, again, you know, understand that bigger picture, that 30,000 foot view, they're very well versed in the moral injury, right? Because that's why young people in your group supervision, you guys are focused on the clinical work, because that's what you're trained, that your job is, that that's how you're an efficient counselor, that that's what the work is. And after you sustain enough moral injury, you realize that's actually secondary to what allows you to thrive, right? It is about insurance. It is about policy. It is about politics. And that's the moral injury of it, is that it is not actually just about the clinical work. Although, of course, vitally, vitally important, we need people who are doing the clinical work, but that also becomes just a small piece of the puzzle. And that's the part that enrages, you know, outrages, anger. Yes. It's heartbreaking. And that's what I write about, because it's real and it's the truth. It doesn't mean that there's not hope for things to get better, but that's the reality of the landscape that we're navigating right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, because Brittany, you said you've been out of for 5 years regarding almost clinical work.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, I joined. I made that pivot I mentioned in the beginning. In December of 2016, I joined Beacon Health Options and kind of learned all the things about utilization management. So, and then I stayed on. I did not want to leave practicing. So I worked Saturdays for a full year, even after I left and joined a managed care company. And then ultimately, you know, just work-life balance, I just kind of had to make that decision to leave altogether in 2017, in like December of 2017. So yeah, it's been a while since I actually have been engaged in clinical counseling. And I want to make that really clear that like, I'm not a person who is doing clinical counseling every day. So I do have a different perspective than folks who are doing this work all the time still. Always leave that option out there for me to go back if and when that felt right for me. But yeah, you know, I feel like I'm still attuned to a lot of the same issues. And I do pay attention. I try and pay good attention to what's happening and, you know, stay up to date with all the articles and stuff that happens in politics and stuff like that with mental health. But I feel like I've able to kind of keep that attachment to what happens because not a lot has changed since I left. So that, you know, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I've had friends too that would have to like, not necessarily quit, but like take a break because again, they would just be so stressed out. They would experience high levels of anxiety due to high caseloads of the clients and everything, and management not really doing enough to really take care of them, you know, when it comes to like just work stress. And again, I've had past episodes about that as well. And I don't know, like I try to be a good friend and just be like, hey, it's fine. Take a break. You're number one to you, you know, focus on your self-care. And you can always come back.
Yes.
I don't know if that's the best advice in the world, but I'm like, hey, it's always there for you. But
yeah, I've actually found a little bit of a solution for myself because I struggle with that as well. And my solution, sort of temporary solution that I found was working a part-time job, doing something completely not related to mental health. So I mentioned that I work in a natural foods co-op store. So therefore I'm gaining new skills in addition to then working part-time in that group practice I was telling you about. So it's kind of a bit of a jungle gym kind of trying to manage all of that, but it's not really too terribly stressful. And because half of my life is working with food and like customer service and just things that are different and like give me something different to think about for half of the week. So I find that that's sort of that job is my self-care job.
Yeah, you know, I don't think there's a wrong way to do it, right? Because we're each just human beings, and we're going to have different needs and have different kind of thresholds for what we can handle. You know, I've known and worked with clinicians who are totally cool with seeing 7 or 8 clients, like boom, 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 back to back every single day. That was never me and was never going to be me. You know, I pretty much identify as a highly sensitive person and Elaine Aaron's definition of it. I feel things very deeply and it takes me a while to recover. I'm a person who can't watch the news every day. I'm a person who's very sensitive to violence on television. Like I just cannot endure that level of vicarious trauma all day, every day. So I was never going to be a person who can meet the 26 billable hours. I was never a person who was going to make, you know, really a lot of money by seeing a huge volume. That was just not going to be me. And that's okay. Yes. That doesn't mean, I thought for a long time that that meant I wasn't developed enough as a counselor. I wasn't doing a good job at it. And we so often, right, internalize what's happening as a failure or a struggle when it was just a matter of understanding my limits, my boundaries, what worked best for me and how I operate. And so if you realize that you can't do it or it doesn't offer you, right, the regulation to your nervous system, the balance, then that's important to recognize. You know, looking back on it now, I wasn't aware of it at the time, but I got sick a lot, physically sick. I was out a lot. I attributed it to I'm in the community and I'm seeing all these people, but I think it was more than that. I think it was my body telling me that I was overwhelmed and stressed all of the time, and that I needed something different. So it's really important to try and be attuned to, you know, even what your physical body is telling you. You know, those have ways of manifesting and letting us know that we're carrying a lot. And so if you can manage that by seeing less people, you know, if you have partner or resources that you can, you know, depend on to help you make it, even for certain time frame, a few months or whatever, that can be helpful. Getting a different part-time job, I mean, or pivoting away from clinical work altogether, you know, like I did. I mean, it's bittersweet. It wasn't what I wanted to do, but I found, you know, a pathway that did offer some better semblance of balance and nervous system regulation in my day-to-day experience. So I think if that's what people are craving and needing, that we really have to find a way to honor that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was going to say that this type of work is so hard because we're literally healers that we're working with people who are wounded and or who are needing that nurturing and that healing like all the time. And it is unrealistic to put that upon us only and expect that we can complete that on a daily basis only, you know? And I think that it's completely amazing that you were able to share that with us right now, Brittany, that you're sharing your experience, because I definitely resonate with me. I felt that, and I really, you know, had those experiences too. And I'm sure the listeners out here have also had those experiences. And just you sharing your experiences and your truth is enough. It's plenty, you know, it's very healing. And I think that we as practitioners often forget how our being is healing for other people. Mm-hmm. And we work so hard to try to be so perfect and to do everything correctly and to, you know, take on that, you know, the extra hours and stuff. And it's like, we have to remember that we have our limits, like what you were saying, and we need to honor that because that is our self-care and our respect for ourselves.
Absolutely. Thanks for your kind words, Rebecca. You know, and I'll also just add something that I've said and written about before, which is that it is okay to leave systems of dysfunction that are no longer serving you. You know, it is not our fault that this system is not designed to be high volume, revenue driven. Somebody once referred to it to me as like a therapy farm, you know, we're like farming people in and out to like keep the cash register going. Like that is not what any of us signed up for. That's not normal. Like we've been trained, you know, towards this disillusionment that that's what healthcare is, but that is totally not what holistic care or what a balanced nervous system looks like for most people. So it's okay to leave if that's what needs to happen. Mm-hmm.
Well, Rebecca, actually, does this get into your big project that you were working on with the interview questions?
Oh, well, actually, interestingly,
this actually looks really good.
Actually, this is so ironic that you brought that up because out of self-care, I chose not to take that speaking position.
Oh, okay.
Basically what ended up happening was I realized that I did not have the proper audiovisual equipment and just things I needed to have that presentation run smoothly. And so in order for it to run smoothly, I would have had to buy a bunch of Apple products. And I don't have the funds right now to afford that. And I wasn't getting paid for this presentation. And I know it's not like they have to pay me, but if I am required to, you know, buy equipment for it and not get paid, I just couldn't afford to do it. So I actually stepped down from that. And then I instead was going to do a YouTube video of my speech and then email it to the person. And I thought that was going to work, but unfortunately, YouTube said that my video was too long and I couldn't work around that. I couldn't figure out how to like work around that glitch. So, but unfortunately it didn't work out. But I feel like on that day instead, which was yesterday, that Friday, during that time that I was supposed to give the speech, I actually went for a walk around the mall where the speech was sort of located, not to go in and gawk or anything, but really just to like get some exercise and take care of myself. So me and my partner, we took a long, nice long walk. We got some really good exercise. We kind of laughing, got a drink of coffee, and then we're like, hey, this is self-care, you know, like this is all about the point of your speech was to talk about self-care, so here I am doing it. And it was just my way of really taking care of myself and saying I'm not gonna put out this money if it, you know what I mean, like it's, I don't want to have it be all about money, but when it really comes down to it, sometimes it is all about money, either you got it or you don't, you know. So
and it sounds like in that situation you were asked to pay to do your own presentation, right? By buying all the equipment and the cost.
Right.
Like that's, how is that honoring your expertise and your time and
right.
value, you know? So that could have very easily, I'm just going to give you a lot of kudos that I don't know. I only know what you just said, but that could have gone very differently, right? Because the cognitive dissonance that we all have is like, well, I couldn't make it work. So I'm terrible. And gosh, isn't that awful? Mm-hmm. But you actually decided to turn that into an opportunity to adhere to your own advice that you were preparing to give, which I think is beautiful because therapists are imperfect people like anyone else. And we often do not take our own advice. So that is sometimes the biggest thing that we can actually take our own advice. So good on you for taking that.
Thank you so much. And I'm not saying that I'm just this like perfect person. Like I did have some depression that day. And thinking like, oh God, I'm terrible, you know, and you know, all that kind of stuff. Like I bombed it or whatever, you know, but at the same time, I'm like, you know what? No, that was not really a fair call for that to happen. So thank you. I really appreciate that validation.
Yeah, that's important work.
Yeah.
And you set boundaries for yourself. You respected yourself because sometimes you got to put yourself in their shoes. It's like, I would never ask anyone to do that. If I choose them for a presentation, there's a reason, and I'm not going to put more stress and strain on to have them buy all this equipment and, again, just make it harder for them to do what I want them to do. There's a reason I chose you. You know what I mean?
I don't think that they intentionally tried to, like, put burden on me or anything. I just think that they were ill-equipped because they didn't have a audiovisual person, like a tech person to help me set up. And I saw what I needed to set up for the, you know, the big screen or whatever. And I know I didn't have the equipment. I'd have to buy some special. And I knew that there wouldn't be someone there to help me hook it up. So I just thought, this is too stressful to do, you know, right before presentation. Like, I will be so stressed out, and I will not be able to do the presentation if I try to attempt to do the audiovisual stuff on my own. So I just knew that about myself. So I'm like, I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah. Well, and ultimately, you know, if they're asking people to come in and speak and do presentations, then you would think that they would have some tools or resources to set you up for success, where it sounds like success was all on you, monetary and otherwise, and that just didn't feel right. So it sounds like you kind of trusted your gut on that
one. Yes. Yes, I did. Thank you.
Yeah, no, and it was really cool just because I know how hard you worked on it and how important the questions you were asking the people, you know, in your project. Mm-hmm. And it's just so crucial and important for all therapists. So,
yeah. Well, I was going to say, Jacob, real quick, is if people are curious about those questions, the interview that I had with John Jankert, he's a marriage and family therapist and works at St. Mary's. If people are curious about that interview I had with him, I can email, it's in a Word doc. I can simply email you the Word doc and people can read it on their own if they're interested.
Absolutely.
I'd be happy to share that. There's no copyright or anything like that with that. So. Okay.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, as we wind things down, I want to ask each of you right now, what are your goals down the road in the next 5 years for what you want to do with your life in this field? So, Rebecca, do you want to go first or Brittany?
Oh, you can, Rebecca.
Go ahead. I'm going to think on it. Doesn't matter. But well, actually, I know this sounds very shocking to some people, but I actually am not going to pursue my LMFT. I've decided. At least as of lately, I've decided that because financially it's just, I don't know how it's going to work out. And then, because I have basically this year to get my license. And then after this year, I'm just, you know, I'm no longer eligible for my LMFT. Cause like it's just been a long road. So I've decided, like, I think what I'm going to do instead is pursue a different dream I've had, which is to focus on food and nutrition. Which is interestingly, I'm working at the grocery store. But I'd like to create a coaching business, working with folks who specifically need help with their nutrition or food or supplements or wellness, things like that. So that's really going to be my next approach. And then, of course, the background in counseling can only help with that, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Awesome. I love that. There's so many different ways to make a difference and to contribute. And so I say this to people all the time, you know, even if you're not doing direct clinical work, there are a million ways to make a meaningful difference, to make a therapeutic even difference in people's lives. It may not be therapy, but there are many things that are therapeutic. There are many ways we can bring holistic healing to so many people, you know, whether you have a license or you don't, you know, to some level that doesn't always matter. It's about you and your connection and your mission and your passion. And so we can cultivate that in so many different ways. For me personally, gosh, I have always been a big dreamer. I accepted a new position that I haven't started yet for a nonprofit in healthcare consulting. Nice. So I'm excited to start a new venture there. But I'm also interested in doing my own consulting. I've started to do some freelance writing. As you know, I'm a pretty passionate writer, kind of developing my skills on LinkedIn and, to some extent have gotten a pretty good response. So that's always feels good. Mm-hmm. But ultimately looking at the sky, I would love to be a part of improving healthcare policy, of being in Washington, DC, of talking to political leaders. I would love to be a person that helps create impact at the highest federal levels. Don't know if I'll get there. I'm scared as shit to say that out loud, but I would love it. So
that's great.
You have us for support. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, guys.
Mm-hmm. Keep in touch, please.
Yeah, this has been so lovely to spend time with you guys. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, Brittany, if any of my listeners do want to get a hold of you, is there a particular email or website they could use to make contact with you?
Yeah. If you just go to my LinkedIn profile, my name is Brittany Lindsay. I know two first names. I blame my husband for that one. My first name is Brittany. And Lindsay, Lindsey. I'm on LinkedIn almost every day trying to create content pretty consistently. And my email is up there. So yeah, reach out anytime.
And Rebecca, do you want to give out your information too?
Sure. I can probably have it sent electronically through you, or if not, then I can just provide my business phone number right here, which is 612-965-8763. That is my business phone, and you can reach it during business hours. Mm-hmm. And then I'll just provide you, Jacob, my work email, and then you can just forward that.
Absolutely. And again, I'll make sure I put all this information too on my show notes, so you ladies will be just one click away for the audience. Yeah, I just cannot tell you what an honor it was to be here with you ladies talking about this kind of stuff. It was awesome. It was an amazing experience.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
I again just want to thank Rebecca and Brittany for another awesome and amazing behavioral health integration episode. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support. And just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behaviorhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.